Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Israel Studies. I'm Yaakov Yadgar, the host of the channel. Today we're talking to Professor Ella Shohet about her new book on the Arab Jew, Palestine, and other displacement. Spanning several decades, Ella Shohet's work has introduced conceptual frameworks that fundamentally challenged conventional understandings of Israel, Palestine, Zionism, and the Middle East, focusing on the pivotal figure of the Arab Jew. This book gathers together her most influential political essays, interviews, speeches, testimonies, and memoirs, as well as previously unpublished material.
Thank you, Professor Yaakov Yadgar. It's a pleasure to be here and to meet you, even if only virtually.
I believe there is very little need to introduce you and your work. Nevertheless, for those listeners who haven't read your work before, can you maybe describe the background for this collection of works, how it relates to the wider trajectory of your career as a professor of cultural studies and Middle Eastern studies?
Thank you. Yeah, this is actually at the core of what this book is about, is an effort to bring together two worlds, as it were, that academically have been separated for quite some time. That is, Middle Eastern studies emerging out of what is called area studies, which is, as we know, a top-down formation that began, you could be traced back to the school of Orientalist studies, but then emerging in the post-Cold War era with government, especially in the U.S., sponsored funding and giving funding to the study of various regions, including the Middle East. And on the other hand, a very progressive, shall we say, field that emerges out of a post-Marxist perspective in one place, of course, can be traced back to the Birmingham School, and the emergence of critical approaches that move beyond the reductivist, materialist approaches. When I was coming of age, as it were, academically, in the early 80s, writing about both the Middle East and within cultural studies methods, the two realms were completely separated. And as someone working in cultural studies, I felt that the study of the Middle East and its analysis were almost completely marginalized, with perhaps one exception now, and that's my framing of the work of Edward Said on Orientalism as a par excellence cultural studies work. But for the most part, the Middle East as an object of analysis within cultural studies methods was marginalized. On the other hand, when I was writing at the time my dissertation on Israeli cinema and basically the Zionist discourse and its representation of Palestine, the field of Middle Eastern studies viewed culture in a very problematic way. Even when culture was studied, it was not studied within cultural studies paradigms. You can say that the most progressive wing of Middle Eastern studies, which was Marxist, tended to view it very suspiciously due to its materialist approaches. On the other hand, you had cultural anthropology, and that field who was at the time undergoing almost a metamorphosis with critiques such as Talal Assad and the critique of colonialism and its formation of anthropology. That could be extended, of course, to the field of geography, history, sociology, etc. So those two realms is where I was, in a sense, writing my first work. Some of it included not only Israeli cinema, say on Egyptian cinema, or on a question of the Arab Jew and rethinking Jews and Muslims. It does not fall, even when I write about history per se, it, of course, does not represent the methods of the field of history. It takes a discursive analysis. And that's really the key method here that is not about, it is about mediation and the kind of reflexivity around question of mediation, which is very much comes within post-structuralist approaches.
The book as a whole is a wonderful testimony to the diverse and encompassing nature of your academic work. Maybe we can go over the different parts of the book and discuss at least in general terms the various fields in which you offer your interventions and the nature of this. So the first part of the book is titled The Question of the Arab Jew. Can you explain what this question is and what has been your contribution to posing it in the first place?
Yeah, the question of the Arab Jew and why I posed it and why it has historically become a question to begin with has to do with a history of other questions and how the Arab Jew emerges as a question. And it has to do ultimately first with a history of European anti-Semitism and the Jew emerging as a question, especially in the 19th century with post-Enlightenment discourses and with the formation of nationalist identities in Europe, and how the Jew comes to form and redefined outside of religious self-definitions and moving into a kind of ethno-nationalist identity that often also requires a geographical understanding. And the whole project of repatriation and restoration and return ultimately emerges for Jews, in at least as it forms as a secularist idea, emerges in that context. So the Jewish question is the response to anti-Semitism and the Herzl notion, ultimately, even as a response to that traumatic sight of the Dreyfus trial, which I refer to in the introduction to the book, is ultimately how ultimately has to be viewed in this particular context. At the same time, there is another question under which or in relation to which my question of the Arab Jew is formulated and why how the Arab Jew emerges as a question. And that is the question of Palestine, of course. And the question of Palestine itself emerges out of, on the one hand, the one can see as the formation of Arabic nationalist movements in response to or in relation to colonialist and imperialist expansionism in the region, but also in relation to Zionism and the Balfour Declaration, and ultimately culminating with the partition of Palestine and the Nakba. So the question of Palestine emerges in that also within a history that is related to the West and the fall of the Ottoman Empire and colonialism. That the Arab Jew emerges in relation to those two questions. It is a question that is part of modernity. It is not, even though we project and discuss the history, millennial history of Jews within Muslim world, it would be impossible to think about it simply as an old question. It is very much a question that emerges in relation to those two questions. And so is our the dislocation and the displacement, dislocation physically, geographically, demographically, from Arab Muslim spaces, and also displacement in terms of new cultural identity formation. So therefore, the whole rubric of in the book that is called The Question of the Arab Jew is never simply about the Mizrahi place within the state of Israel. It's a larger question for me.
So this is intimately tied to the second part, which is titled Between Palestine and Israel, I guess the background to what you discussed now. Can you maybe tell us what the argument is that you're making in this regard?
Often the question of Palestine and the emergence of Israel and Jewish identity as formed within Israel are discussed as, of course, within the conflict. What is assumed within this narrative is that we're talking about two homogeneous national identities. But I am trying to look into the various conceptual spaces and historical moments in which those histories overlap. First, not just in terms of anti-Semitism or Judeophobia and Islamophobia, which is the backdrop even to this section, but also in terms of what are the spaces, for example, in which Palestinian identity is negotiated and experienced and understood also in relation to Zionism and Israel. So, for example, the place of Palestinians within Israel is a great concern to this conceptualization of what is that identity and cultural practices that are formed and shaped in the spaces in between Israel and Palestine. This is not to suggest that somehow it's a kind of a moment of new hybridity as a, you know, as some kind of certain kind of approaches within postcolonial studies celebrating the fait accompli of colonial violence by answering it with hybridity. I actually, in my early work, have tried to complicate the notion of hybridity, looking into the ways that perhaps that we have to distinguish between various forms of hybridities, including hybridities as formed within violence. So the between is not necessarily just about some kind of a utopian space, but rather also about the various ways in which colonial violence engendered those spaces of occupying multiple belongings. So, but it allows us to move beyond the idea that, for example, Palestinians who speak Hebrew and how they are regarded, or Palestinian within Israel seen simply as traitors, or the question of East and West that impacts not only Israel, but also Palestinians because of the history of imperialism in the region and the fact that identities have been shaped within the intersection of so-called East and West.
Fascinating. The third part is about cultural politics of the Middle East. Articles in this part deal with media, cinema, gender, and so much more. What is the guiding theme of the articles in this section?
This comes back to the question of, one, the reflexive issue of how to go about studying the notion of Middle Eastern culture as something that is not separated from the political realm. Because one of the ways in which culture and politics in the academe are seen is, traditionally, is that politics belongs to the so-called hard field of political science, sociology, etc., whereas culture is to the so-called soft fields of arts and literature, etc. I mean, let's ignore for a moment, if we can, the gendered dimension of this troping. For the field of cultural studies, the whole point has been to not see culture as an after or a side effect of politics, but rather, or as a completely separated from politics, but to look into how they're mutually imbricated in each other. So in relation to the Middle East, I try to, this goes back to some early essay in the 90s, looking into the ways that media, cinema, visual culture, literature have all been shaped by this dynamics, context contextual dynamics, but they themselves have also shaped new identities. I mean, my approach, for example, to cinema, whether it's in Egypt or in the context of Zionism, is that cinema is not only, that's not simply, or literature for that matter, they do not only reflect the contextual politics, but they also shape new understanding of identities. So spectators of films are also their identifications with particular narratives are also reflective of this power of cinema to for example shape national identities, just as reading particular articles and this is kind of an argument that has been made about modernity, says in relation to reading newspaper, but the cinema is very, and spectatorship especially in the 20th century was a powerful tool in the shaping of ideologies and shaping of new identity formations.
So the fourth and last part in the book is titled Muslims, Jews, and Diasporic Readings. In a sense, it is the most encompassing part, historically and geographically, at least. Among other things, you put Sephardi history in play with other histories, which at first may seem remote. Can you describe the argument of or the theme of this part of the book?
Yeah, there obviously the key element here, Muslim and Jews, and the notion of diasporic readings. Let me explain what diasporic readings in my work has meant. I distinguish between, there is, of course, in the context of Jewish history, quote-unquote, in with uppercase H, the notion of nationalism versus the diaspora. I don't use diaspora in that sense of with uppercase D, but rather to speak about multiple diasporas. Every history of this demographic dislocation involved diaspora. So in that sense, to simply speak about Jewish history as some kind of a unique experience for me has been very problematic, but this is in the Jewish context. So when I speak about multiple diasporas and looking into, say, the history of Arab Jews, Jews in the Middle East, I'm speaking also about the very fact that one can reread the geographies of Middle Eastern Jews as not necessarily their so only diaspora space with that understanding of Jewish history, but rather their dislocation from those spaces as themselves acts and enactment of diasporas. And the last part of that is actually moving away from the demographic sociological understanding of diasporas into a larger framing, which is a methodological issue, diasporic readings, meaning that we're looking, rather than looking into communities as some kind of homogeneous identities, and rather than looking into simply their narratives, their itineraries of dislocation, we're trying to understand what kind of allegories, what kind of understanding of identities, projections, and displacement takes place. So in the case of Arab Jews, my critique over the years has been that Arab Jews, Middle Eastern Jews, have been subjected to a form of displacements. In other words, their history within Muslim context and the complex relationality of multiple minorities, for Ahl al-Kitab, for example, and many minorities in the Arab and Muslim world, has been taken away, almost kidnapped, and taken and projected into the understanding of European Ashkenazi history. To reread it and to understand it differently, I called it diasporic readings, because not because we are diaspora, but rather because it's all about modes of displacement. Where are you taking this narrative, and from where does it begin, and where is it going to. So this is really the question of diasporic readings, is about moving beyond, and also it is about understanding that identities are never formed in one coherent way. So therefore, displacement are crucial because, for example, the impact of text and ideas moving from one place of another, from one place to another, as they travel along oceans and continents, require that we always understand them not in a ethno-nationalist framework, but to use a more contemporary, recent historically term, the transnational or transregional, because there is constant movement of ideas from one place to another. This is something we also developed in my book with Robert Stamm, Race in Translation. Now, how does it relate to the Sephardic? So, for example, the notion of Sephardic Moorish Atlantic that I, in some of the essays, or the old essays that I've written in relation to the quincentenary in published in 1992, Rethinking Jews and Muslims, and which I later developed into an essay called Columbus, Palestine, and Arab Jews. All those ideas are about looking into the ways that, as one example, is the fact that the so-called discovery of the Americas in 1492 and the expulsion of Jews and Muslims in 1492 have been studied as completely two separate events, historically, materially, as well as conceptually. But in this work, the effort is to actually link them, not only materially, which some historians have done, actually, to look how the dispossessed, how the property taken from Muslim and Jews helped finance the Columbus voyages, but also looking into the ways, and that was crucial for me, how Reconquista ideology about Jews and Muslim, about the other, the limpieza de sangre, the cleansing of the blood of the impure Muslim and Jew, all of that, this type of diabolization traveled to the Americas with a kind of a ready-made apparatus now being implemented first in relation to the indigenous people of the Americas and then in relation to the enslaved African within this kind of conquista ideologies. And then more than that, I look into how, in the case, say, even of Latin American intellectual, they've been obsessed actually with whether negatively or positively, and also in another essay with Robert Stamm on tropical Orientalism, we also look into the ways, for example, the work of the anthropologist Freire even romanticizes the Sephardi and the Moor in terms of the history of Latin America. So they take the negative aspect of the limpieza de sangre, of the impure blood and the rejection of that Moorish Sephardic history in relation to Iberia, and even romanticize it. So they're very complex ideas, and this is here is a diasporic reading. You see, it has nothing to do simply with the bodies of Muslims and Sephardis traveling to the Americas, but it has to do in the way the ideas about Moors and Sephardi are being incorporated and understood in other spaces.
So methodologically and epistemologically, as you already noted, your work is actually a perfect example, I would say, of the field of cultural studies as a whole. It tends to hold an interdisciplinary stance between so many different fields, politics, sociology, linguistic, anthropology, and so much more. So maybe you can say a few words about how you see the role of cultural studies and your work in particular in this wider academic discourse.
Let me start. We'll go back to our early question, in a sense, in relation to the field of cultural studies, because it the idea of moving beyond the way disciplines merge in the academia has been crucial, precisely because while the deep research of a particular discipline helps us see something, it also sometimes blinds us to some other elements in a particular analysis. Now, this is not to say that interdisciplinary dialogue will somehow represent everything. But I think it helps us. It gives us a more flexible way of moving beyond the particular discipline to provide, hopefully, other insights. And this is the way that I believe we can, in terms of the, if we look at regions, for example, and area studies, which is, you know, the field of Middle East studies can be divided into history, geography, political science, sociology, etc. But that, with all the major work that has been done there, we can use this work. This is not about rejecting work, but this is about bringing into dialogue those various disciplines and moving in between them. So if we take the central question of this book, The Arab Jew, if we only regard the question of sociology in relation to Mizrahim, for example, then we're thinking simply about the Mizrahim as an internal question within Israel and the nationalist idea, and that this is an internal gap problem, for example. But if we're taking a cross-border approach that also look historically, that into the history of the dislocation of Arab Jews, we begin to understand and go beyond the criminalization discourse, for example, that and the Orientalist discourse, that all those horrible criminality that inflicted Arab Jews or Mizrahim in Israel has to do with their Arab countries of Middle Eastern countries of origins. If we look historically at what happened to the Arab Jews, say, then we have to discuss the question of trauma of dislocation suddenly. So we move into a whole other field. Maybe we borrow from psychoanalysis. And actually, I do the first article in the book, Sephardim in Israel, Zionism from the Standpoint of a Jewish Victims, I think like the part that deals with ordeals of civility and the internalization of racist discourses that Mizrahim have undergone. And that actually here is an example that challenges some of the disciplinary understanding, say sociology, the problem of the gap, as if it's only, and within Marxist analysis, it would be a materialist understanding coming out of dependency theory, for example. But if we take also, in addition to that understanding of colonialist history and racialist formation and how that actually affected the psyche of the colonized, then that was important for me to take that approach and try to understand the so-called problem of the gap, not as a, some kind of a just in relation to materialism, but rather as a trauma as that was internalized and the ongoing self-rejection in the Arab. And I believe that this kind of discourse and analysis, which was interdisciplinary to begin with, opened up a new possibility of seeing our history in a very different way.
A major concept in this regard, well, throughout the book, is identity. You dive into a critique of what we would usually call the politics of identity, and you warn us against essentialism. Can you explain how you see the very concept of identity and how you suggest we avoid essentialism?
I think the anxiety around identity, let me put it a little bit in the larger intellectual discussion. I think one of the anxieties around the discussion of identity, especially when coming from the left, has been the fear that identities are seen as coming, say, from Marxist analysis that sees it as something that it's almost something that is impossible to really analyze, or it is, can only be understood in materialist terms. But I think post-Marxist analysis and cultural studies move beyond that. There is Another approach, for example, which was sort of like the reason ultimately why we started writing the book Race and Translation, Pierre Bourdieu and Loïc Wacquois, for example, attacked multiculturalism and identity as kind of a calling it ethnic poison, and that that comes out of a certain kind of Republican model of where the Enlightenment ideals as universalist ideals are seen threatened by the notion of identity, which is perceived as something particular. So it's now we're falling into another historical intellectual debate, the particular versus the universal. To articulate, for example, the question of Arab Jew and as a part of an identity debate that challenges the dichotomy of the universal versus the particular, had to be understood not as in any kind of reductionist way. It's not an essentialist argument. Even in my early work, I'm very careful saying the end of the essay on Sephardim in Israel to say that this is not an essentialist argument about or some kind of positive negative that you know, Europeans are bad and Middle Easterners are good, or Mizrahim are good and Ashkenazim are bad. You know, this argument often, when it when we people like intellectuals like us are being criticized, it's thrown back at us as if. And I'm not saying that in the history of anti-colonial or anti-racist discourse that essentialist argument haven't been made. You can find argument that say, even taking, say, Eurocentric understanding that we're essentialist about climate theories, for example, that the northern is rational, the northern part of Europe is rational, the southern part of Europe is irrational, and that actually applied in within colonial discourse. That argument we can find in has been reversed to suggest that the South has been more emotional, etc. But it's exactly the kind of argument that I also, in our book, also on Thinking Eurocentrism, we criticize this kind of essentialism in reverse. And so in my work, I'm very careful trying to make this is a political argument about, first of all, about structures of oppression, but it is also about the way identities are formed within oppressive spaces, also as resistant to it. So it's a kind of a dynamic process that has to be understood. And even if you are part, say, of the hegemony, if you develop a sort of like an alternative consciousness, as it were, the notion of coalitionary spaces are important, in that that means that someone like that it developed a different kind of identification. So one has to make the distinction between identity as something you are born into identification or affiliation. And this is already a discourse from the 90s that was critical of essentialist understanding. And to that extent, it was important to me, this was in the 90s, I write about Arab Jew as a relational, we must develop relational understanding of this history and identity. So even, and also as a method of analysis. So to articulate even the Arab Jew, it's not just a fixed notion of identity. It is mobile. It's relational. And therefore, when we speak about identity, we have to be very careful. At the same time, I don't reject this as a category, analytical category or a historical category. It's a signifier that is a shifting signifier. Let's put it this way.
So let's go back, or maybe not really, to the Israeli case. Your work clearly puts what others may see as an internal Israeli issue inside a much wider framework, or maybe frameworks in the plural. What perspectives is the Mizrahi story put into? What other questions are posed vis-a-vis this story?
I think in the early work, you can see it in some of the essays included here, already in the book Israeli Cinema, I was very much concerned with the way the most critical discourse at the time in terms of academic or public discourse was about the discrimination of Mizrahim or Sephardim at the time, and it was seen as, or the problem of the gap, Be'ayat HaPa'ar, as it was seen at the time, was an internal issue. On the outside, as it were, the external issue was the question of Palestine, was the problem with the Arabs, as it were, right? And the two questions were completely separate, you know, both in the public understanding of how to talk about the experiences that Jews from Middle East were undergoing within Israel, and then the other issue, which was the Arab problem. So I think my work had tried to, this what I call cross-border analysis, cross-border perspective, try to dismantle that that boundary in terms of how we grasp the history of the problem to begin with, which and that's why in the introduction to the book I continue, I believe, to reframe it in a way to suggest that, you know, those two issues are formed together, they're shaped together. And it almost would be myopic to only look at the Mizrahi question as if it only began once we arrived to Israel, and therefore it's somehow unrelated. Even within the state of Israel, the way you can say it has been used, abused for particular political ends, the Mizrahi issue is always there as related directly or indirectly to the Palestinian question, whether economically and politically, but also, of course, what I try to emphasize historically. So therefore, the internal-external paradigm, the internal was we study in the field of sociology, the Be'ayat HaPa'ar, say, or but for me, the notion of not even discrimination, but racial formation were important to understand it within the larger colonial perspective. So even already, if you frame it within colonial discourse, you move it between some kind of an internal Jewish problem that that was shaped within Israel into a larger question in which you look into Zionist discourse as itself borrowing and implementing ideas that were shaped by not only ethno-nationalism in Europe, but also Eurocentric colonialist understanding of identity. So on the other hand, you had anthropology. Anthropology, say, of studying Jews, whether Yemeni Jews or Persian Jews, with their habits and rituals, etc. To the critique of that has been very important to move us as an object of exoticization. So, and just as it was important for me to remove us from historiography of what I call pogromization, that we always see us within tracing the thought from pogrom to pogrom, like there was no cultural production, no complex experiences, and our history is reduced in contemporary museum. If you take any kind of museum about our history or any kind of those kind of persecution models. So in every field, you had a hegemonic models or hegemonic narrative, but there were some, if it was history of persecution, it was a redemptive narrative, and the telos was the state of Israel. So there how you see the division between the external and internal works in every field. So by bringing all this field together, I was trying to dismantle also this nationalist notion that we only understand the Mizrahi within within the state of Israel and unrelated to our previous history and even to our future.
Yes, it's interesting to note how the Israeli Ministry of Education has been trying to appropriate the Mizrahi narrative exactly through a history of persecution and a victimization narrative, just to know that. Now, the book carries a very personal tone. It even carries the images of your parents' Iraqi travel documents. So maybe you can say a few words about this professional trajectory, how it corresponds with your personal history.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I never thought of writing in the first person about the subject in the 80s. I did not. I may have written for myself, or, but not in a public way. Something happened, and that was the Gulf War. What is called the first Gulf War. And in where all the places that my personal biography, the places that have formed me, Iraq, Israel, Palestine, and the U.S., were involved in a war. And, you know, those things affect you. They can be, you know, moments that are, and that actually, probably I would have been resistance. I was suspicious even of autobiographical narrative intellectually. And I think that in some ways I was asked also. I mean, I didn't initiate it. I was actually asked by people who knew me to write an article about that. And that's how Dislocated Identities, Reflection of an Arab Jew came about. But I also felt that this would be probably a way of translating, as it were, my previous writing into a more accessible narrative. And sure enough, actually, this article has been, you know, this pre-internet was circulating quite a bit and resonated with a lot of people, not only from the Middle East, but other people who experienced displacement and dislocations. And that actually over the years encouraged me as I was being invited to speak more about also the autobiographical element, to write more about this subject, because it did become a more accessible vehicle to communicate with wider, with audiences that may have not or could not or did not want to read more academic text. And in that context, it actually freed me, as it were, to write somewhat differently about the history. And I am actually so happy to see today you see so many people, even of a younger generation and older generation, you know, looking into this history and supplying us and bringing us more of their own narratives, which I think enriches us with a fuller understanding of the traumatic experiences. You know, when I was writing those sentences about turning off the radio to the sound of Umm Kulthum, or that, you know, members of the family who were arrested for being mistaken for Palestinians, I knew it was not just my experiences. But I think once you give them voice, now you know that many people are writing about it, and then one can read it sociologically and then understand that there was a phenomenon that was suppressed. So, you know, so those essays, I believe, were a trigger to everything that was suppressed and was taboo. And that's why, you know, the previous work is called also Taboo Memories, Diasporic Voices, precisely because to articulate what was forbidden, one, to speak about those emotional experiences. B, to speak about past memories, you know, because we're supposed only to remember persecution. So I think this wave of nostalgia that we're seeing also now has a political, intellectual, emotional, cathartic function to allow us to reshape our identity. Again, I don't believe that identity is only what we're born with. It's also what we make out of it. And so I believe autobiographical narratives have this kind of important public role.
I must add, I mean, this liberating effect is mutual. I can, you know, I can think of many stories of people who were audiences of these narratives, personal narratives, and all of a sudden were able to reflect upon their own histories, their own identities, through the legitimation that this voice allowed them. So it was doubly liberating in a sense. I think we've taken too much of your time, so maybe you can tell us in closing what project or projects you're currently working on. I remember reading recently your work on Judeo-Arabic.
Yeah, I'm not a linguist, so but my interest in what I call the question of Judeo-Arabic and why is in relation to my other interest, which has been the question of the Arab Jew, and why is it, we come back to the beginning of our conversation, why is it a question at all? It is a question because, like many other issues, just like the invention of the Mizrahim, there is an aspect of invention. Invention in the sense not simply of something that did not exist before and it comes into being with shifting political realities, but also as concept that redefine how we view history, identity, and even languages. So language, the way I'm reflecting on the notion of what is the language called Judeo-Arabic is both historically, but also as a trope to understand the shifting definition of identity and what is permitted and what is forbidden in that narrative. One, because I'm really thinking about a linguistic imaginary, which is the fact, I'm giving example both from the religious liturgical spaces, sites, as it were, but also from secular sites where the notion of Judeo-Arabic was not something that was used even in the specific dialects when it is relevant of Jews who spoke Arabic. You know, sometimes there were separate dialects, but they were not necessarily seen, but it's not necessarily to, when does this idea of Judeo-Arabic emerges? This is really important to me. I'm kind of obsessed sometimes with this question of beginnings, just as I ask in some of the essay, when does Orientalism begin? Only in the post-Enlightenment era, or perhaps in 1492, with the expulsion of Jews and Muslims. The same question I pose. I'm not a historian, and I haven't done a full research to discover when exactly. But I do notice that sometimes in that encounter, even before the Israel, when European Jewish or especially Zionist agents or activists or teachers were coming to the Arab world, that beginning to define dialects spoken by Jews as Judeo-Arabic. Sometimes it is used to suggest because Jews also used for liturgical purposes Hebrew script, even though the language was Arabic. But I actually look around and again, from all those spaces, there was one language, especially in terms of the spoken field, that was common to the Jews in Arab spaces. Jews, like other Arabs of various groups and regions and ethnicities and religions, were also bound by specific contexts in what they spoke. So I take the dialect that I grew up and spoke at home as my native dialect, the Baghdadi dialect. And even though I look at the work of some linguists like Blau, I reflect on this work and say, okay, this narrative that suggests that Jews spoke such a dialect that was so different from the Muslims and they could not understand each other, actually is highly problematic. Well, first of all, the Jews of Baghdad spoke what is called Moslawi dialect, that is closer, in which also Muslim of Mosul spoke. So the Muslim of Mosul spoke a dialect closer to the Jew of Baghdad the Muslim of Mosul spoke to the Muslim of Baghdad. The same thing, the Jew of Baghdad spoke a dialect closer to the Muslim of Baghdad than to the Jew of Marrakesh. So, so one has to put it again, this is the relational method that we talk about, and look into this way in which what is the purpose of, separating. And my major critique is the way that the hyphen in the notion of Judeo-Arabic is actually a separating hyphen that separate Judeo-Arabic, even though the word Arabic exists, it's ultimately in the phrase, ultimately it is about separating it. There is become an object of an it that is separate from the language of Arabic. But Arabic is multiple. It's heteroglossic throughout the Arab world. Why is it that only dialects spoken one Jews, and not always, by the way, there are separate dialects, depends on the region and place, they're separated. And that's actually where I see the Judeo-Arabic emerging as part of a nationalist understanding of Jewishness.
Oh, fascinating. Much to look forward to. Professor Shohat, thank you for being on the show today, and best of luck with the publication of the new book.
Thank you very much.